First time with the program?
I can always spot a newbie. It's my fifth year with Wings.
I guess Paul McCartney's got nothing on me, huh?
Love, take me down to the streets.
It's not a Wings song.
Yeah, it's one of their hits from the 70s. I'm not sure which one.
It's not.
It isn't?
No.
I think it might be.
That's not. Nobody sings that song.
I don't know about that. I'll have to Google it.
TBTL.
Well. Here we are.
I want to congratulate you for being on time.
I got recognized on the street today. Guy had already met me and then forgotten he met me and then recognized me from TV and then remembered me again.
Do not put that on the imaginary radio show.
Hey, you sound like you might be a little bit jealous, babe. You know, and I know a little something about being jealous because people have been jealous of me my entire life.
I feel so full of... What's the opposite of shame? Pride? No, not that far from shame.
Less shame?
Yeah.
Check the just scan the room here in the broadcast center, yeah.
All right, well.
We had a pod dog a minute ago, and now she's decided to go investigate more interesting things. That's a hot start to the show. A yellow lab has decided that this is not interesting enough to hang out for. So my goodness, I hope all of you out there in listener land have made a different decision and you are psyched about this Monday afternoon edition of TBTL. Of course, this right here, this is the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Everything about them just makes me nervous.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
Their round feet, their wet noses, their bigness.
Bringing you my part of the program from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill, in Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City. I was just talking to my friend Andrew Walsh before we started recording about how I spent 4 or 5 hours trying to psych myself up to go for a jog, which is not actually that out of the ordinary for me. It's a long conversation between me and myself every day to get up there and get out there and do that. But up here in the Bay City today, it is like there are wildfires somewhere. I don't know if you guys know this, but the world is on fire, it turns out, and because of climate change. And so this time of year, the same thing last summer, there's just a blanket of forest fire smoke everywhere. I don't really know if that's good or bad for your lungs when you're jogging. I'm assuming not good. I've never heard of it being suggested as a therapy to help one's lungs. So that was just the excuse I needed to not get out there and do my exercise today, was the smoke and the fires. So anyway, that's sort of the latest from here. The Bay Kitty is doing great again. Just to update everybody, she's 100% now. She's back to totally ignoring us and staying out till all hours. So it's kind of nice to have things back the way they were. This is episode 2704 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
And we've got a lot to talk about on this Monday, including an amazing story from Australia, from a town of 11 people that's now down to being a town of 10 people. The guy who has gone missing was a local who would go to the town bar. This town of 11 people has basically two places you can go hang out. One, a bar called the Pink Panther, which has sugar gliders and an alligator living in the back. I mean, yes, this sounds like a Baz Luhrmann film or something. And everybody in the town is a suspect for one reason or another. You call that a missing persons case? This is a missing persons case.
Nope. I cannot believe he just told that joke.
Sorry, we're getting some interference in the line here. I'm hearing some bleed through coming from, I don't know what it is, if it's another podcast that's on the same frequency. I know it couldn't be Andrew Walsh because the informal and never explicitly stated but understood rules for the show is I do my talking and then I introduce the longest running Cobra of the show, and only upon being introduced does he speak. He's a soulful rocker from New Hampshire. He's known for his drawings of tall ships, their grace and their splendor. He's Andrew.
That's the sound of a beer opening. Boop. That's the sound of the Xbox going on. That's the sound of Madden 2018 firing up.
Walsh. And he joins us now and not a second before from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Hello, my friend.
6 years I've been able to keep my mouth shut while you're doing your intro. But I'm sorry, that accent. I'm over here with my microphone turned off.
That's
just like
hilarious.
Scream, like just like shaking my head, saying, nope, stop, stop. And I just had to.
It's actually
had to be
that
heard.
Actually makes this sort of, in a certain way, this is sort of a banner day already on the show. You're right. There have been thousands of shows where I say some dumb crap at the top, and you've always been able to just give me enough rope to hang myself with. And that I finally figured out what it took for you to break in on the broadcast and go, nope, just, and it was my Australian accent.
Just the worst. I actually don't even know if the listeners heard that, because I think I said it right over your drop. But yeah, all I yelled was nope. By the way, speaking of drops, though, and your intro, were those Will Ferrell drops I heard at the beginning? What is that stuff about the wet round noses?
He does this character named Cord, and Molly Shannon does a character named Tish.
Oh yeah,
and Cord and Tish were doing a lot of work around the royal wedding. You know, it's a sort of it reminds me. It's like one neighborhood over from the Spartan cheerleader. I'm sorry, actually, you know what it is. It's sort of a combination of his male cheerleader that he did with Sherry O'Terry, and then his music teacher he did with Anna Gasteyer, where they would sing, you know, the songs, kind of the popular songs, but made more corny and adultish. Anyway, there's a sort of combination of those two characters, this guy Cord. And I just was, for some random reason, I was watching some video of them last night calling the royal wedding, and his fear of horses, which I think is a bit he does, was pretty great. He was talking about the horses that were bringing in. Well, actually, I don't know what the horses were doing. This was a sort of an excerpt, but this is never ends well, but I'm just going to play you a little bit of Cord and Tish calling the royal wedding. Now, this again is not even the same video I was watching yesterday, so this is probably not going to work out. But I'll just play this for you.
What we haven't talked about is the beautiful horses riding alongside and pulling the Ascot Lander carriage.
You know what? Not interested. We don't have to talk about
that. The horses used are Windsor Greys. Their names are Plymouth, Londonderry, Milford Haven, Sir Basil, Tyrone, and Storm. Tyrone and Storm are father and son horses. All the horses are named by the queen.
As you know, I'm no fan of horses, Tish. They scare me to death.
Well, then, you, Cord, will definitely want to be... You would not want a repeat of an incident at the last royal wedding in 2011 when a horse got spooked by the crowd and threw its rider slammed down onto the ground.
Well, that's not what I wanted to hear.
A rider couldn't hold on to the horse, and it broke free and ran wild and crazy towards the crowd until some soldiers finally took control of the horse, calmed it down. Thank God it didn't go off into the crowd and hurt a bunch of people.
You know what? Let's just stop talking about the horses, Tish.
Cord, are you okay?
Everything about them just makes me nervous. Their round feet, their wet noses, their bigness. I just don't like how close they are to us.
They are, well, they're all the way in Windsor, which is 30 miles away, and we're in London.
Okay, but what if they bust loose and they run this way?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, but I was worried that this might happen. So
she does this, exposure therapy for him, where she gets, like, some small toy horses, and she has them in a box, and she pulls them out. He's supposed to close his eyes, and then she presents to him a small, tiny toy horse. And I'll just play that part for you, too. Here.
I'm going to show you a horse, and then you're going to try and see if you can control your fear. Okay, keep your eyes closed. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Open your eyes.
Get that the fuck away from me! Jeez!
I love that they do that. I think it started with the Rose Bowl parade or something. I like that they
I had seen their name around places, or, you know, these characters' names. So I know it's been going on for a while. I have not followed it as closely as I will now, because once again, Both of them, comedy gold.
Not to be nerdy about it, but like what Will, like, because Will Ferrell could have easily just been kind of a, you know, funnier Adam Sandler or whatever, right? The SNL yeah. alum who's just in a bunch of kind of, you know, I don't know, kind of low, sometimes lowbrow humor, kind of, you know, fratty kind of movies. But like, I mean, he started. Funny or Die, right? Yeah, and for somebody from the kind of old school, like SNL being the most kind of old school-y kind of comedy, to come out of that and actually just kind of redefine what you can do in with more modern media, which he just did so early on, and then be like, all right, how about me and Molly just pretend we're different people and, you know, host a Rose Bowl parade or the royal wedding as these characters. I'm not saying it's the most groundbreaking work in the world, but I just love that he's still doing weird ass shit.
Yeah, he doesn't. I was thinking that last night because I ended up watching him and Molly Shannon on the Jimmy Fallon show in these characters. And the thought that was going through my head was like, Will Ferrell is not doing this for money.
Right.
You know what
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like he's rich. I mean, Funny or Die, which came about right at the beginning of TBTL. So we were obsessed with that sort of sketch. What felt like one of the first viral video sketches that was sort of acted out, which was it was Adam McKay's daughter, Pearl, pretending to be she didn't know what was going on, but you know what I mean? The joke was that she is this really terrifying landlady of Will Ferrell's, mm-hmm. and she just screams at Will Ferrell all day. And like that was just like so funny to us, and we used to just play that thing and parts of it all the time on the show. But yeah, like Will, and then they sold Funny or Die to somebody, and I'm sure that they just, I mean, they were both already rich, and I'm sure that that was just a like an insane windfall for both of them and whoever else had, points on that thing. So, yeah, like Will Ferrell is just, this would be fun for me to do with my friend Molly Shannon. It's 100% why he's doing it. And they're in London, too, I think, anyway. I mean, they were really there for it, too. It wasn't even like they went to a sound screen in L.A. Like, they flew to London. They did this whole thing. It's like, it's a lot of work to just do something because it makes you laugh with your friend.
Right,
which
yeah.
Is admirable about him, I think.
Yeah, I agree. That's great.
You did something quite surprising on Friday, and you followed through with it. In fact, you mentioned to me that you were because I stopped by the offices of Walsh, Walsh and Doormat, and we recorded the show. And then as I was leaving, you were like, "Okay, cool. I've still got time to go do some kayaking." And I was like, "Kayaking in Green Lake? That sounds like a new adventure for my friend Andrew." And then sure enough, hours later, I saw you posting a picture from the kayak listening to TBTL on Friday. You did it. How was it?
It was good. And by the way, I was listening to the TBTL Song of the Summer playlist, by the way, that of course, David was on the show Friday. Does he have, yes. How would I know which David I'm talking about? Do we have an audio cue?
Or not anything that I'm aware of.
We need to find something for him.
Yeah.
Maybe
we'll
if it was basement related. Anyway, okay. He was on the show Friday telling us the top 16 songs you can vote for Song of the Summer, which you should be able to do by the time this podcast posts. You should be able to go to tbtl.net and start voting on the 16 finalists. And, you know, this year, because he put it together, I don't know. It's fun for me to like kick back and listen to the music. I think in the years past, by the time we narrowed it down to 16 songs, I had just like slogged my way through so much stuff that I lost all perspective on those 16 songs. And it wasn't like an enjoyable thing for me to kick back and listen to it, like a 16 song playlist. But because David did all of the hard work and he just presented it to us, it was great. I felt like, oh, good. I want to just like sit back and listen to these songs somewhere peacefully. And for some reason, I got this idea of just like, wouldn't it be great just to be floating in the middle of Green Lake here in Seattle and staring at the sky and listening to this? And the idea might have been put in my head because I was hanging out with my friend Brian a couple of days prior, and he had just mentioned, he's a much more fit fella than me, and he had just mentioned that like it's great working from home, and he was able to take a little break and go, paddle boarding on Green Lake.
Oh, stand-up paddle
stand-up
boarding?
Stand-up paddle, yeah. And I don't have the core for that, obviously. But I was like, I could probably just get... If I can just rent a boat and just, like, row out to the middle of the lake and kick back and listen to the songs of the summer for about an hour. And I had... It was, like, one of those things that you and I call a coat hook moment where I was like, I just want this feeling. I have a feeling that if I just get out there, it'll fulfill this weird feeling I'm having right now, or this need for aloneness and sunshine and music. And I got out there. I rented the boat from kids who should not be old enough to be renting me boats. Honestly, I show up at Green Lake. I'm like, where are your parents? I would like to rent a boat. And they're like, we rent the boats here, sir. And it was I've never kayaked before. I mean, it's just a still lake. It's not a big deal. But I asked, like, that 16-year-old kid giving me my boat as I'm getting in. He's helping me. He's kind of holding the boat steady as I get in. And I'm like, I've never done this. Any tips? And he was like, I mean, don't tip over.
I made a video on Snapchat about it. You can watch.
He just said, well, I guess try not to tip over. And I was like, okay. So I just rode out into the middle of the lake, and it was exactly how I expected it. I floated around. I like rode around Duck Island, which we've talked about on the show before. The little island. The Green Lake, by the way, is about the circumference of the lake is 3 miles. It's the lake that Luke and the gang ran around during the 24-hour marathon, to give you a sense. So it's like this lake in the middle of the city, but it's a beautiful big park. And there's an island kind of in the middle of it where people, you used to swim out there with your buddies and smoke fake marijuana, I believe, Luke, or try to smoke weed.
Real marijuana, no wrapping papers. I fake smoked it, but the marijuana was real. Right. I didn't know how to inhale. I still don't.
Right. Sure. No, I'll still vote for you. But I had never actually been close to it before. I've only seen it from the shore. So I rode around that, chased some ducks. One duck ducked under the water, never came back up. I'm still thinking about that duck.
Yeah, that's stressful.
But it was beautiful.
By the way,
it was a beautiful, idyllic
situation.
People may
remember also, Duck Island was where somebody built, they built a skateboarding, like, bowl. Like a, and I thought it was totally cool, but I guess technically it was a bad idea because the argument was that it was bad for, like, the ducks and wildlife that go and live on that island, which, okay, that's, I guess, a real thing. But
I talked to the
ducks. I assume
that
had been had that been dismantled by the time you got there?
I didn't see it. I mean, I didn't walk onto the island. There were a couple of guys, like, smoking, I think, a cigarette or something kind of out on the island. I just kind of,
The island?
Yeah, it looks like they had floated out there in a little inner tube. It's actually not that far from a dock.
Yeah, no, you can walk to it, which, if you leave the shore, and that was why, I'm not trying to hijack your story or make this too Duck Island focused, but, like, one of the things that absolutely, like, entranced me about it as a kid was it was an island. So you felt like it was all this kind of Robert Louis Stevenson shit, like, oh my God, we're on an island. But you could, after the age of about 11, you could literally walk to it without ever having to swim. In other words, I bet the deepest the water is like 5'4" or something. So it's actually not hard to get to, but it still feels like, oh my God, we're out on this island.
Especially if you were kids, I'm sure it felt that way. Yes. Me in my boat and seeing these two, like, kind of adults on the island, and then there was, like,
it's
that
a little
dock.
Weird, honestly.
Well, I mean, they were like probably 20 somethings. Like, it looked like they were smoking a cigarette. Maybe they were smoking a J. I don't know.
That's the whole thing. Yeah. They're allowed to do both of those things on the grass at this point. Maybe not the J. But actually, I don't even know the rules on that. To me, it's like if you're 8, Duck Island is like the world will never know about the crazy experimentation I'm doing here with Todd Staley and Donald Whitehouse and some marijuana that we stole from his mom. But if you're like 20, it's like you don't have to go to a tangle of tree branches and duck shit to do that. You could just do that on the mainland.
They were probably just splashing around. You know, they were in like trunks or whatever. They were probably just swimming and splashing around just like me wanted to go around.
Judging.
Also, I don't think you can smoke cigarettes in a park anymore. I've never seen anybody smoke.
Really?
I'm sure you can't. I'm pretty sure that Seattle must have been an early city to pass that ordinance now. Yes,
I don't agree with that for the record, but
really,
okay.
Even me, recently ex-smoker, I think it's fine.
Outside stuff, though, it's like it's not that. It's amazing how noticeable it is. Like if I'm jogging, there's this guy I mentioned. This is how I don't hijack your story by constantly hijacking.
No, go ahead.
But there's a guy in the park who I've mentioned before. I assume he's probably had some mental illness stuff. He lives in a house That's on the way to the park that looks like it has a lot of people who are living there who are, you know, sort of it's I think it's probably kind of a like a halfway house of some kind. But he walks through the park and he smokes a cigarette. And I can tell if he's been there in the last 10 minutes on a trail.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's crazy how much cigarette smoke lingers now. But I also don't find it offensive. Like, it's not I don't think I'm getting sick from it or it's giving me like if we're outside, I guess maybe that's one guy in a huge park. Maybe if it's if it was totally legal and you had 20 people like at Green Lake in the swimming area all smoking, maybe that would create a different environment. But I don't know. I understand smoking is very bad for us and it creates a lot of really negative effects. But it's like, I mean, at what point have we properly shamed the Hester Prynne's that are smoking the cigarettes? Is it when they're standing around in a corner getting rained on? Like, they turn into, like, Judah Ben-Hur's sisters. They're like lepers. And if you see them on the street, you can chase them with a stick. Like, I don't know.
Well,
and I don't know
is...
how this became a conversation about anti-smoking laws, but...
Well, this is interesting because it does say... I'm on the Seattle.gov, and it says, as of July 6th, 2015, all of Seattle's public parks are smoke-free. However, smoking is allowed in public rights of way, including sidewalks, as long as you're naked and people are hitting you with sticks, chanting shame, shame, shame. No, it does say that smoking is allowed in public rights of way, including sidewalks. So I don't think that means you can walk around because there's a big, you know, path all the way around, like a paved path all the way around Green Lake that you can walk around or run or bike around. I don't think you can just like walk, like just strut your stuff around the lake smoking a cigarette while everybody's trying to exercise, right? That must mean maybe if there's like a sidewalk that cuts through a park, you don't have to put out your cigarette.
Maybe, but also maybe the thought is, look, if you're like rollerblading past someone who's smoking a cigarette, ugh, it's more short term. Like if you're at the beach and you lay out your blanket and you get all set and the person next to you smokes, then you're like stuck with them because you're both sitting there. See, for me, it is just like the smell of being a kid for me is suntan lotion. I was trying to think of the specific brand. Probably what's the tropical one? What's it called? I want to say Tropicana, but that's the casino. Hawaiian Tropic. It's the smell of summer as a child for me. And that is from like 7 to 17 is Hawaiian Tropic, suntan lotion, and cigarette smoke. And I was wearing no suntan lotion and not smoking cigarettes, but the cool kids that I desperately wanted to be around were doing that at Green Lake by the Bathhouse Theater, and I was sitting there, and I was just like, so to me, it's almost like if I were to go to Green Lake and someone there was no cigarette smoke, I'd be like, this doesn't feel like Green Lake to me. Anyway, so you're kayaking around Duck Island, you're out there. I'm surprised you brought your phone too, because like I would have thought you'd be nervous about that going into the water.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really sure. I had never been in a kayak before, so I wasn't really sure how stable they were. I could feel that once I was in them, like, oh yeah, this could tip pretty easily. It's like almost like if you're sitting still, you forget that it's somewhat precarious, but then you just shift your weight a tiny bit and you can feel the thing lurch on you a little bit. So I wasn't really sure what the deal was. I was wearing like I was just wearing like regular shorts and tennis shoes that I took off when I got in the boat, and I just like had my Everlane backpack on. And yeah, I mean, I had my wallet and everything. So when I got in the boat, I was like, "Ooh, I hope this isn't a mistake. I have my wallet, my cell phone. If this thing does go over, everything's definitely getting wet. And hopefully, I don't lose this bag. I tucked it in by my feet in the boat. But I was like, well, first of all, don't tip, like the kid said. And secondly, like, if I do, I don't know, the phone. I've seen those commercials for my phone where Lil Wayne is dumping a whole thing of champagne on it. So I'm like, maybe, you know.
And that lake is 60% champagne, 60%
yeah,
right. Species.
Yeah, so I figured. Is that a 60-60%, did you say? 60?
Oh, yeah, it's a classic. Oh. It's a classic 60-60.
Yeah, that's great. So anyway, I just was like, just chill out. And again, I wasn't, like, doing anything too vigorous. I paddled out there a ways and floated for a while and then paddled a little bit more and just floated for a while. Like I said, kind of chased some ducks around a little bit, not aggressively, just kind of like let the ducks guide me. And just I was only out there for an hour, just kind of it was just exactly what I want. It's funny, you know. I wonder if I can explain this without sounding like I'm trying to be Holden Caulfield or something. One thing that I think I've realized about myself as far as my personality is I like being alone, but also alone amongst a lot of people, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to be talking about this Australian story in a little bit that takes place in a town with a population of 11. And you can kind of romanticize that for a little bit, like this idea of the uber small town life. It's hard to read this story without picturing yourself living there. But
yes,
there's no – but, you know, I know that within a couple of days I would really want to get out of there. I'd want to come back to the city. Like, you know, I'm not a people person. In fact, later on Friday, we were invited over to grill up some sausages at a friend's house. And I told Visa, I'm like, no, I'm just staying home. I don't really want to be around, you know, folks right now. I kind of have my plan to watch the ball game by myself or whatever. So I'm not – I'm definitely on the record.
Tough weekend is for Mariner fans too.
All I want to do is talk about the Mariners right now. It was a great weekend for the Mariners. Just sidebar, I'm not even going to explain it to the listeners. Just for you, Luke, I just want to say that when you sent out the text saying, wouldn't it be weird if we swept the series, I held on to that text. I was like, I feel this too. I feel like it's things. Yeah. Anyway, so I think that really scratched my itch of, like, I love living in cities. I don't want to live in a place where there is a low population because I really like – see, I love people watching. I love feeling like I'm in the middle of a hubbub. I loved living on Capitol Hill here in Seattle because it's such a busy area. Yet most people, if you live on Capitol Hill in your 20s or 30s, it means you're going to the clubs and seeing live music and going to all the bars. That's why you would live there. I was like, no, I'm good with all that, but I enjoy sitting on my porch watching everybody do those things. I sat next to the class clown. And so I think...
You must have been a cool guy. No... But I sat next to him and I studied him.
So I think that probably for me on a nice sunny day, going to the busiest, you know, one of the busiest parks in Seattle, but then floating out to this middle of this tranquil lake where I could see tons of other people floating around, but feeling also very isolated, very alone, and just listening to this music and just chilling and daydreaming was kind of the ultimate. It really fed my personality traits, I think.
That's awesome, man. I'm really glad you did that.
I'll probably do more.
And yeah, if people would like to vote for the Song of the Summer, I found myself listening to a bunch of those songs over the weekend.
Me too. It's a good
particularly
mix,
that,
man.
Yeah, it really is. So good job to DFTB and all the submissions. Good job to people suggesting songs. We're working out our end of summer get together where the Song of the Summer will be revealed in some fashion, I think. So watch this space for that. And if you go to tbtl.net and you, for some reason, don't see the Song of the Summer brackets, our fine, fine web team is putting it together right now. So if you don't see it, just check back. But it'll be there very soon. And anyway, that is a cool thing. Here's another cool thing. We should take a break so that we can promote the show and probably play some advertisements. But then when we come back, we'll talk about this story in Australia. I will suppress the urge to do an Australian accent because I know how it troubles Andrew. And if we have time, maybe I'll talk about my thoughts on Lodge 49, which started out as not unlike that story you just told, Andrew. It started off as your show, and now I consider it my show.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Hijacking your Lodge 49 thoughts, just like I was hijacking your Green Lake kayaking story. Anyway, all of that and so much more when we come back in a moment. It's TBTL. Stay with us.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walked by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I. Sweet.
One of those songs where it's like there's no good place to break in as far as I'm concerned. And also, I would not have known this, although I bet you it's come up on the show before. Chad and Jeremy, who do this song, did this song back in the 60s, British.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know if it's come up. I've never really considered it.
I don't know why it just seemed like a very American song to me. I don't know if I'm not hearing an accent from them. Maybe they should work on their Australian accent. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But
maybe somebody should.
And I saw a picture of them. I saw a picture of them from 2005 playing, presumably, this song. And they look good. They must have been very young when they made it because they're still Still out there, still doing it.
I love that. No song captures summer more for me. I mean, I knew that song from my now somewhat famous McDonald's summer tapes that we talk about a lot.
Rock and Gold?
Yeah, when I was new on the show, there were summer classics and rockin' classics. There were four of these cassette tapes you could get at regional McDonald's, and I went on a quest about 6 years ago to find them all from my youth again. And this featured prominently, and then I didn't realize how much you loved the song. I think, did you get introduced to it maybe, or reintroduced to it via a film?
The soundtrack to Rushmore, I believe, is where I first found out about it.
And yeah, so it's just like so
and I
summery.
Loved it.
Yeah, and this is like me on the kayak. Like, that's the feeling I wanted, and that's the feeling I got.
The duo, Chad and Jeremy, made several television guest appearances. They portrayed the fictional singing duo, the Redcoats, on the February 10th, 1965 episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show that satirized Beatlemania. So they were like a pretend Beatles band on the Dick Van Dyke Show as well.
Nice.
That's awesome. This is me deciding, and yeah, I should ask you.
Here I go once again with decisions.
I want to start. I watched like six episodes of Lodge 49 last night, and I'm tempted to just start talking about it. But you've only seen one, and to be honest with you, and this is the, I struggled even last night with thinking, do I want to talk about it on the show? Because my take on it is, it's fine. It's one of those shows that's good enough that when they end the episode, I feel compelled to click on the next episode.
Or just let it roll, as I say to Vives. We have some real gambling talk in our house when it comes to TV. Like, should I let it roll? Should I let it ride? Let it ride. Yeah. All right.
For me, I'm so, unfortunately, my ability to withstand anything that I don't want to be looking at in the moment is just so atrophied that I don't even let it roll because I don't need to see the end credits, guys. Let's next it. You know what I mean? Like, the end credits, they know. The end credits are like 30 seconds now because they know none of us have an attention span. I don't even have the attention span for that. I'm just clicking through, just chasing the dragon. But I also was like, why bring up a show to – I can think of the 30 things about it that I'm a little bit like, let's just say, that don't work for me. But I'm also watching the show. I also spent 6 hours with it yesterday because it's an hour an episode. So why would I take time out of everyone's life to talk about the negative or what I see as the maybe not great aspects of a show? Like, what's the point of that? What am I doing for the world with that? That's why I don't know if we should talk about it.
Well, how about this? Let's do this. We never do this on the show, but let's just for a second forget about the listeners and just have a conversation between you and I. Did you not know that I've been – recording these conversations that we have every weekday and posting them online?
Whoa. That is something you need to run by a person before you do it 2,704 times.
I don't think it's a two-party consent state that we live in, though. I'm pretty sure I'm legally covered on this. all right, listen. I'm going to hijack.
I can't believe he just told that joke.
By the way, this is a very show that timely. Has a Bill Clinton, I did not inhale, and a Linda Tripp joke. So don't let anybody tell you that this program is not on the cutting edge of pop culture.
All right.
And can I just say this? Mm-hmm. On the day, or I should say the days during which we find out that one of the president's many toadies was recording him surreptitiously, I go with a Linda Tripp reference. Right. It's not that one party recordings are not in the news.
Right.
They're actually the top of the news. And I went back 20 years.
But I think that the Kavanaugh nomination probably has maybe the Clinton years on your brain. Can I give you cover like that?
No.
What
probably happened.
You could have taken it.
No, that subconsciously what happened when I talked about not inhaling weed, which is the actual truth, because inhaling anything scares me. I don't know if it's good. Like, I feel quote unquote uncool that I can't do it, but I also think it's probably been good for me that I don't know how to inhale something because it's why I've never been a smoker or anything like that. But when you say I smoked weed but I did not inhale, for anybody our age, that will always be associated with Bill Clinton saying he did smoke weed but he didn't inhale. And probably that just started me thinking about that. And then, you know, Linda Tripp, I believe, famously recorded Monica. Did she record Monica Lewinsky? Is that who she was recording? I know she was recording somebody. And that was a big, that was a sort of a legal.
I think that's it. Yeah. Or was it?
She was recording a phone conversation with someone. And Linda Tripp, of course, you know, whatever. I don't have to explain who she is.
Right. That's just.
You're
anyway,
too loud, you're too young.
Good example of forgetting about the listeners. So good. We're there.
Thank you.
So what I
now,
was going
to
say.
Back to Lodge 49, should we or shouldn't
yes.
we?
Just having a conversation as friends, I would say. When I saw that you said on the show sheet that you sent me a couple of hours ago saying, you know, I've been watching Lodge 49, I was surprised because to recap, now I'm going to hijack your story. When I Please. Mentioned to you late last week that I watched Lodge 49, I told you the only reason I did was because Better Call Saul is back on. They just started their new season, and I thought it was brilliant marketing and the type of thing we've talked about in the podcasting land where in the actual on-demand, like if you watch Better Call Saul and don't interrupt it, it was actually a two-hour file. One, the season premiere of Better Call Saul, then it just rolled into the show, what I thought was the season premiere of this new show, Lodge 49. And so I watched it just basically thinking, yeah, this is pretty fine, but I'm mostly enamored by the way they got it in front of my eyeballs, and now I'm a little bit hooked. Right. I'm not going to like seek it out necessarily, yeah. but the next time it's in front of me, be like, yeah, that's kind of a safe space for me. There are certain shows that don't stress me out too much. I like the vibe of them. I can sort of half pay attention, but enjoy being in that world, sort of. And that seemed like that kind of a show. And then when I saw that you watched it, I was like, oh, no, I hope you didn't take my talking about it as a really strong recommendation. I think that you have very specific tastes. I was like, ooh, I hope it's not kind of like, Andrew told me to watch this show and it sucks. But it sounds like, based on what you just said a moment
ago, I have
ago,
a very specific set of tastes.
Yes.
I will find AMC On Demand programming and I will binge it.
So here are my two things and then I'll shut up and let you tell your damn story, which is, number one, from your brief description, it sounds like we're in the same place with it, that it's pretty good. I like the universe. We're not going to say it's the best thing ever. But secondly, how are there six episodes? I thought I saw the season premiere. I thought it just started.
There are more than that. Well, this gets into just the minutia of what our particular cable packages are. I will tell you this. On the subject of how hashtag content is forced into our eye holes these days and the sort of a tip of the cap, I don't know how AMC did this, but somehow when I went to, you know, I have like Xfinity. I think you guys have the same thing. So I have this kind of little script, you know, mental sort of script that I follow now where I sit down in front of the TV, I turn it on, and I just hit that Xfinity button because that brings me to my recorded shows, mm-hmm. The on-demand, all that. And this Lot 49 was there, Lodge 49 rather. And I'd read a sort of nice mention in the New York Times about it. You'd mentioned it. And also, I knew you'd said it had some famous people's kid in it, which is not the kind of thing that typically appeals to me on any level. But all of those things were just enough that I was like, all right, clicked on it. And it's Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's son, Wyatt Russell, who, again, this is why I apologize in advance to everyone if I just seem like I'm being, I don't know, just a little bit negative. Again, I invested 6 hours of my life into this thing yesterday, so please understand, I am watching the show, and I will finish it out. I think there's like, I don't know, 10 episodes. But it's slightly odd to watch what is basically Kurt Russell, like a young Kurt mm-hmm. Russell on stage, channeling the dude from The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
But just like he'll sometimes just do a move where he's just so Kurt Russell. And I'm of the age, too, along with Fire Linda Tripp references. Mm-hmm. I'm of the age of when Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China was the coolest dude on earth to me. So to see his progeny in a TV show, who seems like a very likable guy, and I think he's fine. I wouldn't say that he's like the strongest actor I've ever seen yet, but I also looked him up, and he was an aspiring professional hockey player until a number of years ago. So let's cut him some slack. So I watched the first episode, and they kept saying this is like the binge. They kept using the word, like, somehow the graphics on it were like AMC Binge Fest or whatever. They were indicating that I could watch a lot of the episodes. But when the first episode was over, I was like, where do I watch the rest of them? And what I realized was, aha, I have to subscribe to AMC for $4.99 a month.
Oh.
So, of course, I did.
So it doesn't come with your cable package?
I guess I don't have the binge. Like, I think what they've actually done, I'm sure we have AMC. We have 8 trillion channels, but we probably don't have whatever upgrade I just threw on there. And I'm still mad about the dog channel, which was $4.99 a month and was shit, for the record. Nobody subscribed to the dog channel. just tell your robot to put on KUOW when you leave. That's enough. But anyway, yeah, somehow I think that what they did is, and it was very smart. I watched the first episode. I was intrigued enough to want to watch a second episode. They introduced a value for me of $4.99. Is it worth $4.99 for you to watch the rest of the season? And I said, yes, it is. And I did. See. And I'm watching the rest of the season now.
I'm looking at it now. It's exactly what you said. So it did just debut last week. And it looks like they will continue to roll them out probably on Tuesdays. But if you want to upgrade, you can just binge them all at once. That's,
man,
again,
so much for net neutrality. Like, if you have $4.99, you're allowed to know everything about the show. But if you don't have $4.99, you will just get this once a week and like it. So anyway, I don't want to spoil it for anyone. I think it's what really went through my mind watching it was, I go through phases with my media consumption, in particular my television consumption. And so there are periods of time, I enjoy like episodic television, I really do, but there are long stretches. There'll be months of my life where I'm just not in the habit of doing it. And so I just don't. And then my life becomes about all these other weird things. Like, I'll get in a habit of sitting on the front porch and reading, a trashy magazine or looking up shit on Dwell Magazine on my computer. Like, and so anyway, last night watching this show that I would say only moderately entertained by, I found it very pleasant. I was like, oh, this is great. I like doing this. Mm-hmm. I want to do this with more things. I want to go watch Better Call Saul. I never finished Breaking Bad. Like, I like shows that build episode after episode, and it doesn't take a lot, because I would say this about this Lodge 49. It's actually it's a clever premise for a show, but with the exception of about four people, and I'll be curious to get your thoughts, Andrew, but when you and the rest of the pheasants in 9 years have watched all of the episodes, when you and the hoi polloi have finally caught up to where the high flyers like me and Paul Manafort are, by the way, I read this extensive profile of Paul Manafort and how it went wrong for him in the New York Times today, and my thought was, that's exactly how I would have handled it.
Really?
Exactly.
I want to read that. I saw that. Was that in the Sunday paper? Was
so
that one of
good,
the big features?
It probably was.
Yeah.
I found it so fascinating, because it's really, I mean, it's not even a political, the way they wrote this version of it, it's not even really a story about politics. It's a story about somebody who kind of gets on the grift with these oligarchs and these just really shady Eastern European political factions that is making a shitload of money, and then the as they say, the spigot is turned off because this guy Viktor Yanukovych, who they're backing and who they're helping, just he gets taken out of office. And so Paul Manafort goes from making $60 million over the course of, I don't know, 5-10 years to, I'm sure, only making millions, but his lifestyle has become so insane. Like, he clearly had, like, a spending addiction. Like, I joke about how I like to get on Amazon and buy dumb stuff. But, I mean, it's crazy, the stuff he was buying and the amount of stuff he was buying. And instead of just scaling his life down, instead of just being the kind of person who can live on $4 million a year or $1 million a year, he just continued to live the lifestyle, and everything got hollowed out from under him in terms of, like, he's lying, he's falsifying bank statements, he's doing all of this crazy shit. But I find those stories so fascinating, mostly because I think I would have the same problem. If I was making $6 million a year, if I was making $6 million a year and then I was down to just $1 million a year, I would not be able to just live within $1 million a year. I would keep moving the shells around for it to be still like I was making $6 million a year. Unfortunately, that's how I'm wired. I'm trying to not be that way. I also Googled, am I a psychopath today? Which I don't think I am. Because one of the main stories in New York Magazine is an interview with a psychopath. And there was a number of things listed as far as tendencies. I was like, I've done that. Or I can see myself doing that. Turns out I'm not. As far as I can tell. But I really did feel like with this Paul Manafort stuff, I was like, I wish I could be the kind of person who wouldn't go down this road with him, but I think I maybe would.
A couple of things. First of all, I think you're a sociopath, not a psychopath.
See,
so.
I think I'm more likely to be a psychopath than a sociopath.
Really?
Yeah, because sociopaths, yeah, I mean, I just looked at, I looked both of them up today, just for the record. Uh-huh. And I mean, I was perfectly ready to be one or the other or both. But there were things – the thing that's also annoying about the internet is everybody thinks their ex is a sociopath or psychopath, mm-hmm. which is one of the things that was mentioned in this New York Magazine interview with a woman who's a very high-functioning psychopath who did not want to be identified, but who's just like, yeah, this is what it is and this is what it isn't. It's not all Hannibal Lecter. Mm-hmm. It's actually a thing. And she sort of like debunked a lot of the myths around it. But if you try to Google, if you try to get real information about any kind of mental health stuff or neurotypical, or if you're not neurotypical or whatever, you all you get is a bunch of bullshit like Zergnet surveys mm-hmm. that people are taking to find out if their ex-boyfriend is a psychopath, you know?
Mm-hmm, right.
Like, so it's hard to actually get what felt like no, like legit information. But in looking through it, I did, and I was not trying to ace the test, as it were. And I decided I don't think I'm actually either of those things. But I do think I have problems with empathy sometimes. I have a hard time putting myself in other people's shoes over like really intense things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's a little disconcerting. But I guess that's just, you know, that's just my wiring. I don't mean that I don't feel empathy for people. I feel sometimes like a crazy amount of empathy, but then sometimes I don't feel as much as I think I should, if that makes any sense.
Mm. Well, to go back to the
Money
Lodge
thing. 49.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, back to the money thing, and this is me just spinning this conversation even more out of control and back to TV watching.
Cool.
But one show that I've gotten back into, one of my kind of safe space, because that has a real meaning, mm-hmm. I don't like using it. Let's say at one of my happy places or comfortable places, I got back into that show Episodes with Matt LeBlanc, where Matt LeBlanc plays.
Oh,
Matt LeBlanc,
yeah.
is from like 10 years ago, I think it started. It ran for six seasons, I think. It's about this British couple who come to L.A. because they have a kind of a hit TV show in Britain, but then they have to deal with the realities of the grist mill of Hollywood and how they hate it, and they're
is
always trying
any?
To get out.
Okay, keep going.
Anyway.
I had a weird thought. I was wondering if there was any chance that this was a show that was actually about some actual friends of mine, because they went through that exact experience. They were British. He was a director. She was an actor. They worked on a really hit show over there. They came to LA, and it just was a totally different world and really challenging for them. I'm looking up the Wikipedia. It's not the people I'm thinking of. But anyway, keep going.
But yeah, that's what the show is based on. And Matt LeBlanc plays Matt LeBlanc, only a super hyper, like kind of, I mean, it's hilarious because Matt LeBlanc must be a pretty self-aware guy to play this horrible version of Matt LeBlanc on screen. He's a very shallow character. He's very self-centered. Maybe it's the same as shallow. Anyway, it's a fun show, and watching him play himself is really delightful. It's a little Silicon Valley-y in the fact that it's set in one very specific industry, and then it starts to kind of treadmill on itself a little bit. The ups and downs. First they win, then they lose, and they win, then they lose. And it's kind of the same plot over and over, but some really great performances. Anyway, I only bring that up because one of the episodes I watched yesterday was all about Matt LeBlanc's character, Matt LeBlanc, losing half of his fortune. At first, we think he lost his entire fortune, and everybody's being very nice to him because he invested with somebody for years and years and didn't realize he was being stolen from. And then you realize halfway through, sorry, spoiler alert, that he lost half his fortune. So he went from like $62 million down to $31 million. And then everybody's like, but they've been consoling him like crazy. And then they're like, but you have $31 million, and he keeps saying, "Yes, but I lost $31 million." They're like, "Yes, but you have $31 million." He's like, "But I lost it," and like I understand. So back to the Manafort thing. Who knows how any of us would react in that way? But I don't think that it's necessarily a psychopath who. You get used to a certain lifestyle. Sounds like his was especially excessive. That he is very acquisitive. I haven't read this feature yet, but I do think that. For those of us who will never see the multi-millions, understanding the loss, but you do build your life around a certain amount of money. I mean, you just live a completely different life when you're a millionaire. So if half of it goes away and other people say to you, but you still have $31 million, which is more than I'll ever have in my life, you really understand to a degree how it's just not apples to apples.
Yeah, I guess you would just hope that he would have I mean, I don't know why I'm trying to root for Paul Manafort now, because this guy seems like kind of a douche. But like, you would hope that, like, they were timelining this whole thing in the New York Times, and it's like, you know, in these years where he's like free falling financially because he's had no clients in a year or two, and he's made no income, he's buying multiple houses. Or like the New York, they start with this great anecdote of like the New York the New York Yankees. He had season tickets to the New York Yankees that were $230,000. I think it was a box maybe or something. And the New York Yankees like liaison is like emailing him saying, will you and your wife be joining us at the like, you know, season kickoff party? And he's like, yes. And then the New York Times writes in his troll way, you know, Paul Manafort could not pay for the tickets. And, you know, the Amex that he had put those tickets on was going unpaid, you know, for blah, blah, blah. It's like, as you would just, you would hope that anybody, and again, the reason that this struck me is because I don't know if I would have the awareness to be like, okay, it was that that used to be my life. I can still have a pretty great life. It's just not going to be, I have a box, a season ticket box for the Yankees anymore. I can go to a Yankees game. I don't need to spend $230,000 on it a year. I could spend $200 on it a year. Like, and you just, you, I guess when I read these stories about people who really, I was watching some Dateline or true crime show about this woman who embezzled $51 million from a small town, I want to say in Illinois or maybe Iowa, somewhere in the Midwest. And she spent it all pretty much on these horses. She was obsessed with like quarter horses.
Ooh, I'm scared
and showing
of those.
These horses. And my father-in-law used to raise those. Their wet noses, right. Their closeness to us.
Yeah.
They are actually, I'll tell you what, their bigness is no joke.
Yeah.
Cord may have a point in all this. But same thing, it's like these, you watch these people, you can see the point in the story where they could have got, like they could have, they could have stopped the damage. Mm-hmm. Like Paul Manafort could have, he could have stopped millions of dollars ago. First of all, he could have reported it. He should have just had all the income be taxable. And then he could have, at some point when he realized, okay, the long-term projections are not going in the right direction for me, let me sell three of my nine houses. There was another anecdote in the story about how he apparently had a swimming pool moved by like 3 feet in one of his estates so it would get proper light and shade. And I was like, I would definitely.
I was
going to
say,
if I had the money.
Say, okay,
which
now I hear what you're saying.
Which,
great.
By the way, brings me back to Lodge 49.
Okay, great.
The main character in Lodge 49, the story is he and his dad used to have this like pool maintenance business. And his dad dies unexpectedly and kind of leaves him and his sister with a bunch of debt, and their lives are just kind of decimated by this. But a lot of the imagery of the show is built around swimming pools. He keeps going back to his childhood home where they have this kind of like amazingly awesome slash kind of shitty like 70s pool that he grew up going in. And there's all these scenes of them jumping in the pool. And literally as I was watching it last night, I was like, I might just have to go out and jump in the pool right now. Like, just the swimming pool element of the show is enough to keep me moderately interested. But what I was going
to
say about it was,
you need to get the pool channel is what you need. You get The Graduate.
Andrew,
you get Lodge 49.
That's an on-demand show that I've watched. World's Most Amazing Pools. It doesn't have any voiceover. It's just shots of swimming pools with like kind of peaceful, vaguely European music going on behind it. I didn't know that's what I was clicking on. I thought I was clicking on a show about cool swimming pools. It is honestly like it's one click up from just like a screensaver from the 90s. It's just photos and video of amazing swimming pools, mostly way too over the top and garish, and then just kind of like smooth jazz playing behind it.
That's like
it
that took slow. That's like that slow TV thing. Remember the BBC released like 5 episodes of slow TV that were like 4 hours of a camera on a train and then some shots of that train going. Like it wasn't all just one shot, but it was just meditative. It was like 4 hour meditative shows. There was one all about knitting. Does that ring a bell to you? I think we talked about it. On
it does
show.
Ring a bell.
Yeah.
And I just like. It took me 6 minutes to figure out that this was what the show was. I kept going like, God, this is a long intro package. When do they start? Like, when does the host walk out and go, we're going to show you some of the world's coolest swimming pools? And I was like, no, this is the show. It's just these pools. But the thing that struck me about this Lodge 49 was I think it's actually not a terrible conceit for a show, which I'll let people find out on their own. What struck me was I think that it has some of the worst acting. The majority of the cast is horrible at acting, like noticeably bad at acting. And then like you have, including the lead character, God bless. But like, in my opinion, And then there's a couple people that are standouts. Like his sister is amazing, I think. There's this guy who plays a cook. She works. His sister works at kind of a like a Hooters kind of restaurant called Shamrocks. And there's a guy who plays like the dishwasher who's amazing. His name is David Urie. I looked him up last night. He's amazing in the role. There's like three or four people that are just like standout, unbelievable. Oh, the guy who plays Blaze, the guy who runs the I can't say that word.
Apothecary.
What is the
apothecary? Apothecary.
Apothecary. That's the guy who runs the apothecary.
Do you recognize, him? Yes, he's from Strangers with Candy. He's Stu. Simmer down, yeah. Stu.
And he does these amazing like hour long improv live plays in Chicago with TJ Jagakowski,
who's
the other dude from the Sonic commercials.
Right.
That guy, Thomas Pasquia or whatever. He is unbelievably good in this show. This show, Lodge 49, is worth watching just for that dude. He's so good. So good. So you have like
Simmer
people
down,
that are amazing.
Stu.
Sorry.
These people who are so great in the show. And then just like the majority of the characters are horrible at acting. And I kept just watching it like, oh my God, this is, and yet, I don't know, just keep clicking on the next one, keep clicking on the next one. So again, that's unnecessary negativity about a bunch of hardworking people who are probably wonderful. I just thought like, for a lot of the casting, I was like, did these people try out? And you thought, oh, that's the best guy to play that plumber who has and I don't mean the main guy, although I also think, I'm trying to wrap my mind around his acting, the kind of main guy who is trying to become the head of the lodge. But like there's just all these random, there's a lot of like cameos by people or very short scenes with people who just seem like they're not good at acting. Maybe part of it was for realism. They wanted to have non-trained actors or something.
What about surrealism? Now you've watched way more of this than I have, but watching from the beginning, and I'm not saying this is an excuse.
My father was surrealism. Just call me realism.
Obviously you have a beef, Stu, but please don't stir things up.
I cannot believe he just told that joke.
I've only seen the one, and I feel like sometimes shows will do this as a mask. They will kind of create kind of a surreal feel and then justify maybe not the most precise acting in the world because it's like, well, it's this surreal world. But I did get the vibe that like the way that this is shot, it has a very dreamlike quality to it. Some of the scenes are things that are happening in his head. I'm still a little confused about the throne room that he sees in the first half of the first one and like what's real and what isn't. And there's like a touch of that. And so there is, because I hadn't really noticed the acting that much. Oh, by the way, I did see Mission Impossible 18 or whatever it is this weekend.
Did I over?
Well, I knew what I was in. I'm not a huge Mission Impossible guy. Like, I go to those movies and eat popcorn. I don't really care. Mission Impossible, I always find them kind of laugh out loud pretty bad. Like,
right.
But that's why you go. Like, Marvel, let's tie this together. Marvel, I watch those movies, and even if they're completely ridiculous, I don't care because what I do is in the back of my head, I remind myself that picture this on the pages of a comic book. Comic books are ridiculous. This is taking a comic book and putting it on the screen. Whereas Mission Impossible, I guess its roots are in kind of a silly old show from the 60s. But maybe because people are not dressed up like, I don't know, mutants, it's more glaringly silly to me. But, you know, it's fine. But I kept on thinking of what you said about, what's her name, who plays the CIA director, who's the actress?
Oh, Angela Bassett.
Angela Bassett just turning in the performance of a lifetime.
I don't know. Maybe that was unfair. And I poisoned the well. Yeah, exactly. That's why it struck me.
Right. It's a compliment to her. You know, she's a great actress.
She has turned in some really amazing performances, but this was not one of them.
But anyway, I do think that there's something maybe about maybe these weird acting things, or maybe at least for me watching it once, it was kind of glossed over because it's just a little bit hard in the first episode to kind of get a feel for the show, like what's real, what isn't, who's acting bad and who's just kind of over the top. You know, this is clearly a show built around really weird characters that are turned up to 11, you know?
Yeah. You know, and again, I'm happy that I'm watching it, and I know that I don't know why I need to focus on the negatives around. The one other problem I have is that the tavern in the lodge is way too nice.
Oh, so like, yeah, that hit me right. I mean, I belong
like,
to the Eagles.
Have you been like, in an Elks yeah. club? Like, you belong to an Eagles. It's right. in an old knitting store, literally,
right.
like yours. You know what I mean? It's like, right. that is not, like, and it's more, to me, it's more interesting. You know what part of it is for me, too, is like, I love the movie Trees Lounge, okay,
oh, yeah,
with Steve Buscemi. And it's because I love movies that portray kind of like shitty bar life in what I think of as being fairly realistic terms. And I think the show's more interesting if the Lodge Tavern, because it's the story of this kid finds this ring and it belongs to kind of like an Elks Club type of deal called the Lynx. And he goes and he gets really into it and he wants to become a member. But like, show me the Elks Club or the Eagles Club or any of these fraternal orders. Show me the bar that looks anything like the bar in this show. And to me, that was almost like right away. I was like, well, you've already missed it. Like, this could be so, there could be so much funny, interesting humor played through just how shitty the bar is. You know what I mean? And it's like, none of that's happening. And I think that was a missed opportunity.
Even our Eagles lodge, it's called an Airy. Even our Eagles Airy, like, if I have a complaint of ours, it's that our building is too new. Like,
I agree.
Our chapter used to be in, well, it was the very first one. So it was in a very, very old building, but it moved, I don't know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago to this
well,
new.
Well, that building was worth about $1 billion.
The one and that so they, now we were in downtown.
Now it's Act Theater.
Yeah.
If anybody's been to Act Theater, in Seattle, the what I think of as the new location of Act Theater, because it used to be in Lower Queen Anne, it is in the building that I think used to house the first Eagles.
And it'll say Eagles on the outside, like in the stone. But
yeah,
yeah. But if anything, like I love our Eagles club, but I haven't been there in a while now. But if I have a complaint with it, it's that it's too well lit. It's too new feeling. It doesn't even have like that old, like the one in West Seattle is perfect for me. I really like the one in Ballard. They're, you know, kind of more of the standard, like fake wood walls and, you know, the
right.
ghosts of,
but even this is like
past.
That. The problem with this one, right? Like, so most of these places, I'm in agreement. The ones that I would consider the quote unquote cool ones would be the ones that have just been sort of untouched since the 1960s.
Right.
And that's what I like to go for in a bar, in a fraternal club, whatever. The Seattle Eagles is a wonderful place to be. And every time I'm there, I'm delighted that I am there. But you're right. It's in a building that doesn't quite make sense.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't. It's not old. That's the thing. It's at least not old enough. That being said, it's a great place and everybody should join. If they want to or whatever. I don't want to sound like
but
besmirching that airy. But then the problem with the one in this show, Lodge 49, is
it's nice.
It's like a nice brew pub.
Yeah, like, it's like really nice.
It's not old and crappy, and it's not overly new. It's like if there was just like a really nice bar with a great like polished wood bar and brass, you know, taps and a clientele, or I should say a membership group made up of like the exact right amount of every ethnicity, and people are just like on a Friday night, it's jumping off. I mean, it looks like a TGI Fridays commercial. It's like, you guys have missed maybe the best part of this show could be would be the dingus bar culture. And I'm thinking specifically of a member of the Eagles / also a patron of the Pinehurst Pub,
who is
not me and is not Camaro Kev,
we talked about on a recent show with Genevieve.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Some of those, as I mentioned, some of those later shows were a bit of a blur for me, but like those are the kind of characters you could bring into this story instead of just like a kind of background woman who's like a high school, she's been a high school teacher for 10 years or whatever. Like, let's get a guy trying to pull his junk out, and now things are getting interesting.
I will say this, though. See, I totally agree with you. Yeah, no, we talked about that. Was in one of those later episodes.
I know. In case people missed that episode. And by the way, I'm talking about myself in case I missed that episode.
Right. You're not talking about yourself. You are not the person who pulled your junk out. But,
no, I was not. No, sir.
Let's make sure that there's no confusion there. But sure. Now, so that I completely agree with that that critique of that bar. Boy, we're really going into this. But here's one thing that I thought of, and my brain clicked and said, that's not, you know, realistic. And then I was like, I dismissed it right away because of the type of show it is, which is also like everybody who's in there, at least the leadership that are in there, are wearing their ceremonial garb for whatever fraternal order this is, the Lynx, which You know, you see a little bit of that. I think when Veeves and I went through our secret induction, maybe somebody was wearing a hat. I don't really know. But, like, you certainly would not just show up to the Eagles or probably, in a lot of cases, the Elks. I think maybe if you are – if it's a hall for veterans, like, didn't you used to belong to
VFW? The American Legion.
The American Legion. You'll see people maybe sporting, you know, somehow they might be sporting some sort of, like, military, or maybe you'll see, like, kind of patches or badges. But in a place like the Eagles, you're not going to come in and somebody's going to be wearing a sash because he is the grand poobah of the Lynx Club or whatever. Yes. But in the show, they're wearing it, and I'm like, yeah, but that's fine. Like, to me, it's sure. Like, yeah, this is a broad show where if they're going to make something about a lodge, they're going to go for it. And they're not going for hyper-realisticness or whatever the word is.
Right. Well, after all of that, again, negativity that was unnecessary for me, I will say that I'm enjoying it because I actually have kind of been like, okay, that's what this show is. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and that's rare for me. I don't know how I'm somehow turning this into a story of triumph against the odds by me. But I have done it. I have triumphed over my normal amount of just, like, internal voice criticizing everything on a TV show or movie, finding the parts of it. And maybe it started with seeing that Mission Impossible movie.
Maybe. You're a whole
different
guy.
Maybe it started
guy.
With Angela Bassett's performance of a lifetime, where I was just like, cool, she's the steely head of the CIA or whatever. Fine. That's what we're doing. I'm in. Like, you know? Because honestly, like, even for all that stuff for what I think of as some sort of dicey acting and some overly broad stuff, with this show, I powered through 6 episodes and really did enjoy it enough that I'm excited to watch the end of it. So that's where I'm going to leave that conversation and start this one. This is a conversation about donors of the day and what great people they are and how amazing they are and how they are the only reason that TBTL can happen. These are some folks who donated to the TBTL-a-thon this year, and we appreciate it. It makes a big difference. If you consider doing the show or not doing the show to be a major distinction. So with these people, we are able to do the show, and without these people, we are not able to do the show, and that is the big difference that they made. Robert Rowe of Sammamish, Washington. Robin Burlingham of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Ooh, Saskatoon. Mm. That just sounds exotic. And I was near Ilwaco this weekend. I was down in Long Beach, Washington for my buddy Anthony's wedding. And I remember we had a donor from Ilwaco last week. And I
Mark.
Said, I think it's near a river. And then as I was driving and seeing the signs for Ilwaco, I mean, I guess there is a river down there, but it's not, I don't think that's what it's known for. And then I was just mad at myself. And the whole drive, I was thinking, I really screwed that Ilwaco reference up. So anyway. Robin Burlingham of Saskatoon, Jim O'Donnell of Brookline, Massachusetts, Annette Streak of Brampton, Ontario, and Owen Ferret of Sarnia, Ontario.
Is that a coincidence?
You put this list together.
No, I didn't.
I don't know what the spread. Well, I don't know what the, yeah, I don't, I feel like we do this sometimes where we find ourselves in this place where it's like a bunch of people from the same region, and I'm like, are we organizing these alphabetically? Are we organizing them, like, regionally? I'm not sure how we ended up with back-to-back Ontario donors, but and a Saskatoon in there as well. But man, thank you so much for your support. We appreciate it. Robert, Robin, Jim, Annette, and Owen. We couldn't do the show without you. Thank you for listening all over the country, all over the world. We're honored to be your place to turn to for totally pointless television commentary, where I spend a good 45 minutes mildly crapping on a show only to say I'm enjoying the hell out of it. I mean, where else can you find that kind of content? So thank you for supporting it.
Look out, Eric Deggans.
Day in and day out.
All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
All right. So here is the question now, my friend. An hour and 7 minutes into this, just crossing the river. Oh, you know what is near a river?
Mm.
St. Cloud, Minnesota.
That's right.
Do we hold the top story? Do we hold the Australian story for tomorrow and just do some emails and V-mails?
Yes.
Because I feel like if we launch into this, it's a long story with lots of cool twists and turns. So let's do that. If you're cool with that, I'm cool with that. I will now activate the official email sound effect.
Email every week. I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man. It's not from a female.
And then at what time, Andrew, do you and I turn off the microphones and just have our own conversation about the Mariners for 1 to 7 hours?
I know. Well, I mean, if you want to talk about the Mariners, we could keep the mics open and do just a quick unofficial no point. But let's cross that bridge when we get to it. Let's start. You just mentioned our pal, the Stewbot, who is safely across the river as he hears this, I hope.
Sure.
He actually left us a voicemail earlier today. He's got a conspiracy theory related to our newsletter.
Oh, jeez.
Hey, dummies. It's Stu from Internet. Calling about the newsletter, which is very enjoyable. Keith Lolo and Andrew do a great job. But I've noticed something that when Andrew does the Hey Dummies video, it goes into my primary folder. I have Gmail. And when Luke does the video, it goes into my promotions folder, which is like where the your Blazer Rewards coupons for Buffalo Wild Wings go. I'm wondering if this is on purpose, if Andrew's trying to, do some sort of weird, like, fake news thing with Luke, or if this is just a weird coincidence. I'd be happy to listen to your explanation at the tone.
Beep. I don't know. That never occurred to me. I've turned off those tabs. I don't think you use Gmail, Luke.
Nah, not really.
People who use Gmail as a primary, email folder, they instituted something like 5 years ago where they just created three tabs for you, your main folder, your promotions, and I don't know, one other thing. And it always seems stupid to me because if I'm getting a bunch of promotions stuff, either I need to unsubscribe from those things or I want to see them, keep them in my main folder. Otherwise, they're just going to collect in there. Like, there's never going to be a moment where I'm like, okay, I've done my work for the day. Now let me open up my promotions tab and just go through a bunch of spam. And as Stu says, Buffalo Wild Wings points. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. So I turned that shit off a long time ago. But other people who are using Gmail, keep an eye on this. I would love to know, is there actually a one-to-one correlation that it goes into your promotions folder when Luke is... there's no way that could possibly be...
Why would that happen?
There's nothing that could lead to that. It might be that I'm writing about certain things on certain days, like maybe the Song of the Summer stuff just seemed more promotional this time as opposed to when I'm... I don't know, bearing my soul about whatever. So, but I would love to know if there's a pattern there. Oh, anyway, yeah. Also, speaking of listeners and emails and stuff, really quickly, I think I saw some chatter on Facebook. People are excitedly getting their mugs, but I think some are a few people at least got mugs that came in the mail and they were crushed or smashed or broken inside the box. So, obviously, I think...
They ordered pre-crushed, though, and honestly, if you don't want that, don't... Don't click that box when you order the mug. I mean,
what if we send broken mugs?
Gotta be honest,
to people,
that's user error.
What if we send broken mugs to people who didn't donate? Like, we just collect all the broken mugs.
These broken mugs.
But anyway, email me about that.
More mournful music than Mr. Probably Mike and the Mechanics, I guess.
Yeah, I think
Mr. Mister is a lot like Broken Wings. I guess Kyrieleisa is considered to be an upbeat number. I heard Broken Wings on the radio the other day. I was like, this song is so depressing. Mm-hmm. This song just like gives. Just who gets a good feeling from the song Broken Wings?
No, I don't, certainly. Was Mike and the Mechanics' big hit? I used to play that, The Living Years. I used to play this in jukeboxes in L.A. a lot.
Really? Also, yeah.
There was one jukebox at, God, I can't remember the name of this little dive bar. I used to love it, and then I complained when it got taken over, like Mac and Jack or something. It's not Mac
and Jack.
Frank and Hank. And they had a jukebox that only had CDs in it, not like these newfangled, you can play any song ever. And this was one of the songs on the jukebox, which is how I started listening to it a lot. Every generation. Dude looks like Phil Collins, man. Blames the
one before. The Mechanics were actual Mechanics he met at a Jiffy Lube.
True story. Big Car Talk fans. Come beating on your door. This is a terrible video. It's actually like home movies. He's singing about his dad, but it's inner. Oh man, him staring at photos of his dad. Not to be disrespectful, but this is a very poorly made video. Okay.
Well, about once every 6 months, we have this conversation about Mike and the Mechanics on TBTL because Jessica and I, for years, have been sitting in usually the Mandarin Gate late at night trying to remember what's the other Mike and the Mechanics song. And it is Silent Running, I think, which is the very, like, kind of – it's like Red Dawn, basically. It's like a very scary version of the world. And it was also a big radio hit. And as a kid, I would hear that song and I would become very – I was very scared because I grew up in a household that believed that a world crisis was nigh. And I hated that song. And I honestly played that within the last year. We've played.
I know
Silent
Running. This whole thing is coming back to me now. I remember having this conversation. I will say while I let this build up behind me, though, to finish my thought, if you're having any issue with any of the, if you got a broken mug or whatever, email me, andrew@tbtl.net, and I'll make sure that you're talking to the right people. I can't kind of monitor all this stuff on social media, so
we can hear you. We can hear you calling. Over your broken mug.
All right. So that's good. Let's do some more voicemails if you're into it. What else we got here? Nice. How about nerd parties? Do I still have this thing kicking around? Do you remember when Genevieve was on the show? She mentioned that she had gotten into a car accident as a teen, and she was making fun of herself because she was at a party, but it wasn't like she was smoking or drinking or anything. She was like playing Pictionary, I think.
Something like that. Something extremely, non-rebellious.
Yeah. And so
Ooh,
anyway.
Is that what anodyne means? I keep seeing anodyne and I never really know. I misused Inveigh during the wedding reception on Saturday night and I'm still trying to live that down. Yeah, no, anodyne. That's good. Not likely to provoke dissent or offensive. Inoffensive, often deliberately so. I love it. I'm glad you did that because I saw it like three times in different articles over the weekend and was like, I got to learn what anodyne means.
Yeah, I think in this case I probably meant more like tame than anodyne. But anyway, so we got a listener, we got a voicemail from a listener who also wanted to talk about the kind of nerdy things she did in high school.
Hi, this is Rachel. I'm currently a main 10. I was calling actually for Genevieve. I just heard your story about going to your nerd party and totaling your car. I'm so sorry about that, but I just wanted to offer some nerd solidarity. When I was in high school, the thing that we would call a party was to have a fancy dinner party with all of our friends. And no alcohol, of course, no illicit substances of any kind. And then afterwards, we would really tear it up by playing a game called Dictionary, where you pass around a dictionary and pick a strange word and everybody makes up a definition. You have to guess which one is the real one. So
that's homegrown balderdash, right?
Cool. I think so.
Anyway, power out.
And don't they do that on Says You, the NPR grammar quiz show?
The game of wit and whimsy?
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. Tell me another. Probably. Yeah, I think they do that, some version of that. I love that game. Yeah, we would play a version of that. What's funny is being an adult who is probably even at 42, occasionally goes harder than is advisable. I was right in that world as a kid. Like all of the high school, I went to one high school party with drinking, and then I got hammered. Thank God most of them I went to were like church related, and there was a lot of Pictionary and Balderdash being played. No one had alcohol. No one had drugs. No one did anything. We would like sometimes we'd sing worship songs. This is not even a joke. I'm very familiar with that. And I don't know why I'm getting into whether or not I'm a psychopath or sociopath today. And then I don't know why I'm going into this world right now. But what's weird is that was so fun to me, those parties. Like, I don't remember feeling like I was missing out on anything. Like, cool, we're hanging out, we're eating pizza, there's going to be board games, let's do this. And now I'm like, I would be like, you're telling me there's no alcohol here?
Right, what? I like, know.
That's a joke, right? Okay, if you need me, I'll be at the lodge in the beautiful tavern. Right. It's weird to think that there was many, many years of my life where it was just kind of like, this is enough. And now that would be a little weird for me. I think I could do it, but it would certainly not. I would notice the absence of alcohol from a get together on a Saturday night. And I didn't at all up until the age of 21.
As would I. OK, at least one more voicemail here while we're on a roll. This is related to something we're talking about much more recently, which was card counting yesterday on the show. Nope. Friday on the show, Thursday.
Sure. Yep.
You and I were talking about how we find it odd that card counting, I don't think we ever said it's illegal. We know it's not illegal in the eyes of the law, but that it's illegal within the walls of casinos.
They have the right to kick you out of the casino for card counting. You will not be arrested. It's not considered cheating, but they have the right to say you cannot play here anymore.
Now
they have the right to do that over anything, and and that rule exists because of card counting.
And so here is what Mike in California says about that, because I'll be interested to get your reaction to this, Luke.
Hey, friendos. Listener Mike in Sacramento here. I was just listening to episode 2703 in a collector series discussing counting cards. As far as I know, counting cards itself is not illegal. It's not even discouraged in casinos. In fact, you can go to gift shops in most of the casinos and find books that are all about counting cards and the methods therein. Long story short, you're both correct. There's no crime in thinking and being able to do quick math in your head and, making an action on that at the table. What's illegal and what became famous in movies is when two people or more coordinate and give signals to another player who's on the floor as to whether that table is quote-unquote hot, which means that the count is particularly low. I just hope that clears everything up. It's not the actual act of counting cards that is illegal. It's the coordination and teamwork that is an obvious skirting of the game's rules. Power out.
I have a big announcement to make, but before we get to that, Luke, what do you think of that voicemail?
Well, it's clear to me that Mike is, I'm sure Mike knows his way around a blackjack table. I take some interest in it. But what I would say is, I don't think he's wrong, but I know that if you are in a casino, let's say, and you'd have to be playing a lot of money for this to even become a thing. In other words, if you're sitting at a table and it's a $25 a hand limit, or you know the minimum that you have to bet every time is $25 a hand, and you take $1,000 off of them, they're not going to get the pit boss over to analyze how you're playing. But if you're sitting at a $500 a hand game and you're betting table minimum for a long time, and then all of a sudden you start betting $2,000 a hand or $10,000 a hand, if they see you, if you're playing in a game that has big enough stakes, and if your betting pattern is erratic enough where it's like you're not betting very much, and then all of a sudden you're betting enormous amounts more and you're winning a lot, if you do that over a sustained amount of time, depending on the casino. Now, if it's some giant Vegas casino, you could win $1 million. They probably wouldn't bat an eye at it. But depending on the casino, they can take a look at you over that, because they reserve the right to kick anybody out of the casino, or at least basically tell someone you can't gamble here for any reason they choose. And if you went into a casino and you were playing by yourself, one of the ways, I'm just kind of saying the same thing over and over again, but one of the ways that they figure out if someone's counting cards, and it's so hard to do, by the way, that's why they sell books about it in the gift shop, because most dinguses like me will buy that book and then think, I'm going to be the next Ben Mezrich. I'm bringing down the house. And then I don't really learn how to do it, and I can't keep track of the numbers, and I go in and I just lose the same amount of money I was going to lose anyway. For those who don't know anything about card counting, the very, very simple idea behind it is when there are mostly cards worth 10 in the deck, so either actual 10s or face cards, that is when you have the best chance as the player of winning. And so what you want to try to do is keep your amount you're betting relatively low while there are lots of low cards in the shoe, you know, and once you figure out that that amount of 10s has hit a certain point in the deck, cards worth 10, that's when you start upping your bet because now you have an advantage. And of course, it's so much more complicated than that and so much harder to keep track of. There are very complex ways to count cards and very simple ways to count cards. And I've never been able to do either one effectively. But so anyway, I don't disagree with what the caller said. He's right. But I also think you could conceivably get kicked out of a casino counting cards sitting there by yourself. Again, it's not illegal. They wouldn't arrest you. They would just say, thank you for your business. We can no longer allow you to play blackjack here. But it's a gamble for the casino, too. I remember we talked about on the show a couple years ago, there was this dude in New Jersey who was just winning like millions and millions of dollars a day for like a sustained amount of time because he was just like whale of a gambler, which isn't a comment about his physical appearance. That's people who bet a lot. And he had gotten these casinos in New Jersey because they wanted the action because they're gambling too, right? They could win off of this guy millions of dollars or they could have to pay him millions of dollars. He would get these deals where like they would refund him certain amounts of his money if he lost and give him special rights to do this and that and like with the cards or would play by himself or like if you are betting enough money, there's a lot of the they can't bend the rules of the game, but they can do all kinds of incentive programs and things like that. He had also been banned from a bunch of casinos because he was just winning too much. So that's a very long, boring way of saying I was trying to work anodyne in, but I couldn't. It was a very long and boring way of saying I agree with the listener's not wrong, but I do think you could conceivably get banned from gambling, banned from blackjack for counting cards, even if you weren't colluding with other people.
All right, do you have the...
Now what were you going to say
fan,
6 hours ago?
Do you have the fanfare sound effect?
Always. And by always, I mean sometimes.
All right. Kiki Lolo has just posted the Song of the Summer page, and there's something special going on this year that I forgot to mention last Friday. This was her idea, and thanks to her for putting together – I really outsourced all of the work this year. Yes. Kiki Lolo has put the Song of the Summer page up. You can find it if you go to tbtl.net. Let me double-check that right now. Well, we're going to get a link up there soon. And then by the time you hear this, it'll be up there. But here's the cool thing. So you can go there to vote as you normally would. But also, Christina had this idea of creating a printable, like a printer-friendly bracket that you can just print out at home right now and fill it out with how you're going to vote or your predictions of how you think it's going to go, it, you know, just like you would for like a basketball tournament.
March Madness.
And then you can post it, share it on social media using the hashtag TBTLSOTS. That's TBTL Song of the Summer. And then she's going to put those together on a page and we'll see who got the closest to reality.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, you win $1 million.
Yes, but we have the right to not pay you that $1 million.
If we think you've been counting songs.
Right. No
we
counting
can actually,
songs.
We can invalidate your victory.
So that's really cool. That's something that was Christina's idea that I love. So go to tbtl.net. You'll be able to see what all the brackets are. You can place your votes and you can also make your predictions about how you think the brackets are going to go this year. Very fun stuff.
All right. I wrote down – I don't have any show titles. Did anything jump out at you?
I wrote down one, so I guess we're going with it. Here cool. I go once again with decisions. That's all I wrote down, unless you can come up with something spicier right now.
Can it involve anodyne?
It can. Anodyne of Green Gables.
But should it? I love it. All right. It has nothing to do with the show, and it's perfect.
Hey, you know what? I know.
Could
I'm
we call it? Could we call this episode Ryan Healy?
Ryan Healy.
But did
man.
You see
that guy?
I know. And yet, did you see the end of the Cubs game though?
No. What happened? That was
did
the national game yesterday, right? No, I haven't heard anything. That was they were playing the Nationals, I think. Is that
yes?
Right?
Yes. There was something called, I'm going to forget the exact term for it, because I didn't even know it was actually a thing, but it's called like the ultimate home run or something. It's only happened three other times. It's only happened three other times in Major League Baseball history. And here's what you have to do to hit the ultimate home run or the golden run or whatever. And this rookie who's only played in like, I don't know, a handful of games for the Cubs did it. The way that you hit the ultimate home run is it is the bottom of the ninth. The bases are loaded. Your team is down by three. There is two outs and two strikes on you, and you hit a grand slam.
So it has to be a walk-off grand slam that you only win by one run. Walk-off
grand slam that you only win by run. So you needed the grand slam. Like, I mean, I guess you could have gotten away with three runs, but it's like you won the game. You were down by three, and it was two outs, and you had two strikes on you.
Wow.
Because with the Mariners, I mean, Ryan Healy hit a home run with two outs and two strikes. It was a solo shot. Actually, did he have two strikes? It was definitely two outs. Ryan Healy, yeah, he had two strikes, I think.
Did he? I can't
anyway,
remember.
Anyway, Ryan Healy hit an incredibly dramatic home run for the Mariners to tie the game, take it into the extra innings. We eventually won in extra innings. So that was amazing, and I was just like, I couldn't believe it. And then you turn around. And by the way, isn't this just a perfect description of a snapshot of our life versus Chris Hayes' life? Because he is a diehard Chicago Cubs fan. I'm like, Ryan Healy, yeah. And then it's like, hold my beer. Golden home run for my team. Get over yourself, dude. Get over yourself, okay? That's all I would say about that.
How are the Cubs doing now? They were struggling before.
They're good. They're
right?
Leading. Oh, but now they're leading by three. They're leading by three games.
Were they struggling in the first half of the season, or am I just mixing up my teams?
They were not playing as well as they have played in years past, where they've just been like world beaters. The last few seasons, they've turned in some incredible. They've played like the Red Sox are playing now, with just like these gaudy win totals. They're not doing that this year, but they're still playing well enough that they're currently in the lead in their division. But like that, so I'm very excited about the Mariners and this big old series coming up here against Oakland. But I was like, of course the Cubs have to hit a goddamn perfect home run in the bottom of the ninth. And it's not, they got to one up our man, Ryan Healy, who I know you're worried about. I've been thinking about your text message about being concerned that he's too hard on himself. And I normally would dismiss that, but I actually think you might be onto something with that.
I mean, I like it. I like the intensity. I didn't realize it until I think it was last Sunday I heard. We're just doing no point now. We'll wrap it up in a second. Sure. I actually got to meet somebody in a little bit, so we can't go on too long. Don't worry, dear listener. I heard an interview with him. It was maybe two Sundays ago after a game. I can't remember exactly how he performed. But I actually think he performed well, but it was during this conversation about Cano coming back and where Healy's going to end up and whether or not he'll still have a regular spot, at first base or what have you. And he sounded a little cliche-y in a post-game interview, like athletes often will.
Healy did,
but he sounded... But I truly believe he believed it, and he was so intense. He's just like, I'm just going to show them. I'm just going to show them that I have a place on this team. That's all I can do. All I can do is go out there and play my hardest. And it's like, it was cliches, but I could tell that he was really internalizing it. He was very intense about this. Like, I am going to prove myself that I belong on this damn team, which you really love. I mean, you know, especially when you see some kind of lackluster performance and then a kind of a languid interview afterwards, like, yeah, you know, gotta get him next time or whatever. You want to kill the player. So him just, you know, and then like he missed. No. Did he try to steal second on Saturday? Or maybe he was just thrown. Maybe he was just trying to make it an extra base hit and he got thrown out at second or something. And he's getting up and he just slams his helmet in the ground. But he's not mad at the other team. He's not mad at the umps. He's mad at himself. He just has put so much pressure on himself, which
he's a big helmet slammer.
He is. And
like after he hits into a double play, he'll do that sometimes too.
Yeah. And so anyway, but I mean, I like it. I'm glad. I think it's good for the team. I love that he wants to be a Mariner so bad. He wants to be on the roster, and that's cool. But I do hope that he's, you know, giving himself, just like when I'm tough on myself on this show, I'll get a bunch of emails from people saying, Andrew, you're okay. We love you. I hope that somebody is sending Ryan Healy those same messages. I'll send him some of mine.
Self-care.
Yeah.
It's absolutely all about self-care, Ryan Healy. Yeah. That was a very, very exciting weekend.
And the games
of baseball
were good. I mean, it wasn't just the record. It's not just that we came out and did what we did, but they were great games, especially Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, it wasn't like, and granted, a number of the Astros key players are hurt right now. So that gave us some help in that department. But I mean, the embarrassment of riches that is the Houston Astros starting pitching staff is just insanity. It's like, well, we beat Dallas Keuchel yesterday. He's a, you know, Cy Young winner as of 2 years ago. His ERA during the month of June was something ridiculous. He had the lowest ERA, I think, of anybody who pitched five games. So he's just like been dominating of late. We beat him, which is crazy. We beat that guy Gerrit Cole in the first game, who I don't know much about, but he's like unhittable of late. And then who else? Then somebody else. I mean, it was four games. There was two other super top flight pitchers for the Astros. Like, they have no bad pitchers in their starting lineup.
Yeah, I can't remember who the other ones are now. I'm trying to look it up on the fly. But yeah, definitely Keuchel. And I think, like, last time we saw Keuchel, he beat us, right? Weren't we at that game together?
Yeah. I like, came in a little late and sat down and didn't realize it was Dallas Keuchel.
Yeah.
I thought that, like, an Amish man had, like, crashed the field and was pitching. And then I was like, oh, is that Keuchel? Well, shit, we're done. And I was not wrong. Like, we couldn't get anywhere on him.
Hey.
So the fact that we beat these really good pitchers, we're going up against this guy Mannion tonight for the A's, who has a no-hitter already under his belt. It's like we get no easy days against any of these pitchers in the AL currently.
This is a huge series for us. Hey, listen, I'm going to take a huge left turn out of sports talk for a second. We should address something here, because I meant to ask you about this off the air.
this seems like as good a place for it as any.
I think I know the answer to this, but we should probably address for listeners. I was flooded with emails and or actually more like Twitter messages on Friday night as that breaking news story of the guy who stole the airplane out of SeaTac Airport and flew it. And I mean, everybody knows this story. It's fascinating. The tape of him talking to the control tower is fascinating. And I know that immediately as it was happening, and we didn't even know what was going to happen yet, I knew about it before it hit any of the newspapers, because people were tweeting about it and sending it to us saying, cannot wait to hear Andrew and Luke's take on this. And they thought of us probably for several reasons. We talk about SeaTac and Seattle and Alaska Airlines all the time. So if you're not from around here, you
that
hear those
exactly
words.
That is exactly the plane that I fly on. I don't mean maybe that literally that one, but that type of airplane that he stole is – I'm on that airplane a minimum of once a week, that kind of airplane.
That's the one
funny.
That you take down here from Bellingham to Seattle for the quick trip. And so
often from Seattle to Portland as well. It's like if you're kind of sticking within the Bellingham to Seattle to Portland to the eastern side of the state, it's all that plane, Horizon Air, that you know, two propeller plane that he took.
So here we are, I mean, actually closer to almost the second river now than the first. And we didn't talk about it at all. And I know a lot of people, just because we have they associate us with this part of the world and, you know, flying and all and skyjinks and all that stuff. And so here we are. We end up not talking about it. You and I didn't talk about that. I assume only because, yes, there's a lot of colorful detail there, but it's also a story about suicide, and it's kind of not a fun story.
Tell your friend to cancel their plans. Actually, Carrie and I are going to go to hang out with our neighbors who are not Rich and Linda, but who are in fact real, who own this really cool restaurant in Bellingham that we love called Saltine. And we were chatting with them, the husband and wife who own this restaurant, and it turns out they live on our street. We didn't know that, so we're going to go over there. And yet I'll have to call them and cancel these plans too, because here's my big issue with the way it's been reported. I don't feel like the guy was suicidal. I mean, I think he had a lot going on. I think he was dealing with an emotional breakdown of some kind. But I don't really understand where they get suicidal from. I mean, he was taught – unless I missed something, and I listened – I think I listened to pretty much all of the air traffic control tapes that were made available. And, I mean, again, he was somebody who was really dealing with something. He was coming disconnected from reality in a way, or thinking that was a good idea. But they said that he crashed because of either a lack of flying skills or attempting to do some kind of a, you know, maneuver that was not advisable, which would also be filed under lack of flying skills. Like, I don't think the guy was suicidal. I think he kind of snapped. I think he got up there in the air. He didn't really know what to do next. He wanted to take full advantage of it. But at no time did I hear him say he wanted to end his life.
I don't want to take the counterpoint and say that he was. I don't know what was going on in his life. It's clearly very bizarre, though. And I was reading a lot of follow-up stories about his personality and his life, you know, just this morning. And, you know, it's a sad story.
I'm not trying to be like argumentative, but it's very possible that I just missed this. There's a real piece of information out there where he said at some point that he wanted to end his life. I just didn't hear that. And I was confused as to why he's being, and maybe it doesn't matter, but I didn't hear that anywhere he was actually like wanted to end his life.
No, that's what I was saying. So anyway, so I was reading all this stuff and there was no indication that necessarily he had a troubled past as we would expect or no outward signs of that. But certainly listening to that tape, and I listened to it twice this weekend of him talk. And if people haven't heard the tape, I mean, it's really the most fascinating part of the story, although it does have such a sad ending, is he's just talking like a normal kind of cheeky guy, almost busting balls a little bit with like the tower that's trying to help him, you know, find a place to land the plane. But there's definitely a point in that conversation with the tower where they keep on trying to guide him to places where he can maybe safely land the plane or at least minimize damage to certainly any bystanders or himself. And they're mentioning Lewis McChord, the base around here, where maybe he could land on the runway there, or they were saying, well, at least take it low over the water. And he does say in the tape, like, no, can you imagine if I landed at Lewis McChord, those guys are going to beat the shit out of me or something. He didn't say beat the shit out of me.
Well, right. That's the person who's not suicidal. He's trying to not die. He says that they have anti-aircraft there and that they're going to beat him up. He doesn't want to die. He doesn't want to get beaten up. He doesn't want to get shot out of the sky, and he doesn't want to get beaten up when he lands. That's why he passes on McChord, in my opinion. I just find it so odd that everyone's describing him as suicidal, and I have not seen anything where he said he wanted to die.
Well, okay, let me just – that whole thing about like him – there's a realization as he's talking with these folks that who knows what was going through his head. Nobody can get into his head. But, sure. You know, it seems to me that he got in this airplane maybe not knowing exactly how it was going to end. Maybe he didn't get into this airplane thinking this is how I end my life tonight. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. But I would say that there's certainly a moment in the tape where he is balancing the options of trying to land in a safe way where maybe he could survive. But then the ramifications of surviving this would not be preferable to just going out in a blaze of glory, because you have him saying, no, are you kidding me? You want me to land on a landing strip, an airbase? Yeah, how do you think my life is going to be then, essentially? And then he also, talks about, hey, maybe I can get out of this. You think I can get a job at Alaska Airlines? And the guy's like, yeah, maybe. Who knows? He's like, come on. Like, don't even say that. I'm not going to get a job at Alaska Airlines. I mean, I think he's showing who knows at any point what's actually going through his head, but I'm making the argument that even if he didn't get into this plane thinking this is going to end in my death, although it must have been a realization he had that that's a possibility, I think certainly at a certain point he knew that he was going to run out of gas and he was going to kill himself, because surviving this mess did not seem like a good option to him anymore.
I see. I interpret it completely differently, what the stuff that he's saying to them. Because I don't think that he thinks – I think my opinion is that he thinks that there is a way he can, after he's had his fun with flying the plane around, potentially land it somewhere safely, whether it's on the water or on an island. Or apparently they said the authorities that were flying – I forget who it was that was flying the jets behind him. Is that – do I assume that's the Navy? I don't know who that is. But that they were trying to get him out over the Pacific, because they just wanted – you know, they were trying to minimize anyone else getting hurt, which totally makes sense. But and this is maybe just one of those interpretation things. I took everything he said to be like, I think he didn't want to land. I don't think he saw, and I don't know what was going on in his mind any more than anybody else does. But I don't think he passed on JBLM because JBLM was like a sure thing. He would be fine, but then he'd be in trouble. I think he was like, I can put this down somewhere maybe, but if I put it down there, they either might shoot me out of the sky before I get there, or they might shoot the plane when it's on the ground, or they might beat me up when they pull me out. Like, they're going to be the most mad at me. I think he was worried about people being mad at him. He apologized to his family. To me, it's like, if we don't know, like, as far as the authorities go, if we don't know if he was suicidal or not, and there may be stuff they know about it that we don't know and that I don't know. So I have to totally, like, admit that that is very much the case. But based on everything that was out there for normal people to read about, I didn't see anything where he said he was suicidal, and I find it weird. I feel like if we don't know, why are they characterizing it that way? Like if it's up in the air, so to speak, I would just think it would be like we would just not comment on it, or they would not comment on. And again, maybe they know something that I don't know. But because this was the whole at the wedding afterwards, everybody, the reception on Saturday night, everybody was talking about this thing, and we were also just kind of having this conversation about, like, you know, what was going on for this guy and what was he thinking. And I agree with you, Andrew, that he had to know at some point that this was something that was going to very much endanger his life. Like, there was a really good chance he wouldn't survive this, because it's just, you're flying a friggin' commercial plane and you don't know how to fly a plane. So I don't think that he went into it thinking this will all be okay. I think he was probably made peace with the idea that this might be the end of his life. But in hearing him talk, I honestly think something just snapped. He got it up in the air and was just kind of like, what do I do now? And, you know, it's heartbreaking to listen to him, because we know that his life ends, and also because of he's actually pretty funny at times. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like he makes this sort of poorly timed joke about crashing into people. And he wasn't trying to say he was going to crash into anyone. And you can hear that's where the air traffic controller gets really serious. And it's like, don't say that. Mm-hmm. I bet you the air traffic controller knows that if that guy says that on the radio a couple of times, they're going to shoot him out of the sky. Mm-hmm. Like that's like making a joke at the TSA times 1 billion. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, he says no, I just want you to whisper sweet nothings in my ears. Like he's just clearly a guy who's, as he said, you know, kind of a broken person or something. I don't know. It was a really sad story and fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, it was. Apparently he and his wife opened up like a cupcake shop or a bakery in Portland for a while. Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like, you know, he's just a. I almost had Colton Harris Moore vibes a little bit, because
that was what we were talking about on Saturday. Really,
yeah, because that's different. Now Colton didn't, you know, as a matter of fact, didn't you have Colton on like for like some sort of a premiere interview on your old Luke Burbank show? The Barefoot
Bandit, maybe.
Anyway,
it's possible.
You know, that was a sad story, because here you had this kid who was just incredibly clearly gifted and smart in various ways, but brought up in a pretty kind of broken situation that led him to a life of crime. But what you end up seeing is this like preternatural ability to teach himself to fly and go around stealing people's private airplanes. And he was kind of they called him the Barefoot Bandit, because he would take selfies of himself before and after stealing things and then kind of crash land the planes but go on. And they caught him, and he's doing time. But it's one of those things where I really hope for the best.
Well, he's out now.
He is out. Oh, that's right, because that's when he was doing that round of interviews. But you really wish for the best, because you're like, you have some sort of a special mind to be able to do this. You are clearly more talented. You have something in you that I don't have, and hopefully that can be harnessed for good. And I just keep coming back to this guy, and it's like, whatever it was, yeah, he would have faced some real shit for pulling this off, which nobody should pull up, which nobody should do. But it's sad, because he sounded like a very interesting, capable, like some sort of beautiful mind situation that's now, you know, blinked out.
Yeah, you wish that he could have just, you know, landed it safely, which, I mean, I don't know. That feels like one of those things, like taking off. That's, you can probably take one of those things off so much easier than you can land it, I would just imagine, for obvious reasons. Not that it's easy to take off with one, but like if there was some way that he could have just landed it, and then he would have been in big trouble, but he you know, could have done his time, paid his fines, maybe gotten some help, and like gone on with his life. I mean, it was so unnecessary, and you just hear in his voice such a normalcy and such just like a guy, like you could be having a beer next to that guy at Teddy's, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? And it's just like, it's so sad, because. And then we also got why should I take this here at this point when we've now crossed three rivers, Andrew? But we another part of the conversation on Saturday night was, yo, you give that guy a sort of non-white, like I guess you could say Middle Eastern sounding name. That plane is not going to be in the sky for that long. That plane is not doing barrel rolls over Chambers Bay, which is another thing. Even in this, there's an element of white privilege, right?
Yeah.
It's like we're not threatened by this guy, at least not the way we would be if it was somebody who we think of as being more likely to be in the category of a terrorist. I mean, there's like so many weird layers to this story.
Well, yes, actually, I do wonder that. And again, this is one that I don't really want to debate, because I don't know if you and I could ever really come to an answer on it. I don't know that protocol would have been different. You have somebody in a stolen plane who's doing loop-de-loops and in touch with the tower, and you have these F-15s that are scrambled. I don't know that they would have been quicker to shoot that down. They probably were following various protocols, although there is some differences between what we've now learned, what the tower was telling them to do and what the jets were telling them to do. But
Oh, really?
I'm trying to think who it was. Somebody, it was the jets who were trying to get him over the ocean. But then meanwhile, we hear on the tape that the tower is saying, don't go too far over the Cascades because then we lose contact with you. So the tower was actually trying to keep him in range and trying to land it, whereas protocol was to get him over the ocean, which is what the jets wanted, something like that. But
interesting.
Anyway, I don't know if that would have changed. Like if there's a person who's stolen a commercial jet and or airplane and they're flying it around, I don't know that it's different, but I definitely think the story, the way it's told in the media, the way it captivates the general imagination of average Americans or the majority of Americans would be different. I think it would be talked about much more like terrorism, certainly.
I agree with you that the protocols officially would be the same, but what I wonder about, and there's no way of knowing this, I wonder how much just like implicit bias, like let's just imagine that the person is speaking in accented English and they identify themselves and their name sounds like somebody who we associate with acts of terrorism like, you know, 9/11 or whatever. And then does the anxiety level go up for everybody involved in such a way that they start talking to the person differently and then the person's reacting differently? And then, you know, those are unknowables. But it was I was just talking about this kind of like, isn't this guy a folk hero? And then somebody at the wedding was like, yeah, because they didn't shoot him down because they assumed he was, you know, to some degree non-threatening, you know. Again, there's no way of knowing how it would have unfolded differently. But a sad thing nonetheless. And
You purposely leave it off the show sheet? So I guess not. Did you just not kind of think of it today?
I figured that. I don't know. I guess I just didn't know what we would say about it other than what we just kind of did say about it. And I don't know. I didn't agonize over whether to have it on or off. I guess maybe I thought it might just come up because it, particularly up here in the Northwest, as you mentioned, it is still like it's all anyone's talking about. It's like, you know, 9 stories on the cover of the Seattle Times. It's just such a banana story.
Yeah.
And again, not to make it like. Carrie often used to have this joke like, how do you think I felt when there's some story that's, you know, someone's going through something really hard and then the person who's been talking to them goes, well, how do you think I felt or something? This is not a story about me, but I will say having spent a lot of time on that model of airplane and then watching the video of it flying around, I just was like, oh my God, like this is, I mean, this is, I can imagine being in that airplane very clearly. You know, anyway, so it's just a nut story. And I wasn't trying to not talk about it. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. Cause I was thinking about it all weekend because so many people thought of us. And then I was like, how do we handle this story? Cause again, like when that tape was out and, I think the tape might've been out before we knew it crash landed, you hear him just joking around and stuff. I mean, it is fascinating and human and all of those things we like to talk about. But then when you know the end, I was like, wow, yeah, do we start off a week like that? But what I'm happy about, though, is we were able to squeak out a show today. We found a few topics that we liked, and we hit on them very briefly. And I think we've gone long enough to call it a show now, probably, right?
I just think, I know there are Webbies and Prindies, and what are some of the other Peabodys? Is there an award for doing the least with the most?
The lengthies?
Like,
are you talking about the lengthies?
Oh, God, are we up for another lengthy? But we're in the category of who said the least useful amount of stuff about the most broad-ranging topics.
Right.
Just to remind everyone, I promoted a story about a missing person in Australia, which we never got to. I then spent roughly 49 minutes more or less disparaging the show Lodge 49.
This is good,
by
the way.
Telling people they should watch.
I'm writing the show description as you talk because I can't remember what we talked about.
Perfect.
So this is good. We did Lodge 49. Okay, what else?
And then we tried to end the show and then started talking about the Mariners because I suggested calling the show Ryan Healy.
Oh, right.
Then we talked about my growing animus for Chris Hayes because he's got to do everything better and more than us, including team home runs. And then just last minute, as we're literally going, what should we call the show? Any kind of music to go out with? We just subtly transition into a conversation about a person who lost their life stealing an airplane, and I managed to say almost nothing of any, with no nutritional value, and tack another 30 minutes on the end of the show.
But we're able to just like kind of also throw in conversations about suicide and white privilege at the very end as well, too. So
this is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we can tackle
doing the least. Right. With the most meaningful topics once again, and once again winning the lengthy,
right?
TBTL. By the way, we do have the show title finally, and it is The Lengthies.
Okay, cool. Just The Lengthies. That's good. So tell me why
you
wanted to end. Yes, I'm changing it now on the show sheet. Why did you want to end? I see you have a specific song picked out, and I'm ready to play it. But it sounds like you had an idea, or
I just was listening to Pandora today when I was doing some stuff, and the song came on. And I've always kind of liked the song, but I don't think I ever even knew it was of Montreal. Then I was wondering, is it the Let's Go Out Back Tonight song? It's not. It's like a different one. And then it made me think, maybe I should listen to more of Montreal because I really like this song. I like the Outback Steakhouse commercial song. I think I was always a little put off by of Montreal because of their just sort of like wild stage presence.
This song.
Do you know this?
Yeah.
This is that one? Does he say "Let's go out back tonight"?
No,
what is
the lyrics
line?
Are different. They
change the lyric, right?
They change it for the rib commercial. Yeah, this is what.
Well, it's not a rib commercial. It's Outback Steakhouse,
The steakhouse. Yeah, but I always think of them as a rib place. But no, this album came out, and then they bought the rib place or the whatever Outback bought the song, and they changed.
Have you
the
been
lyric.
To an Outback Steakhouse?
Yeah, I get ribs there.
You cool that a rib joint? This is a rib joint.
Anyway, yeah, I went through a pretty intense of Montreal phase back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, I was under the impression that the song that got changed for the Outback Steakhouse, the classic rib joint, I was under the impression that song had a reference to going, like, I had heard that there was something, like, I thought that the song was closer to what it became in the commercial, and they just changed, like, one or two words. But it sounds like this is, like, they just wrote 100% new words.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. It's a weird thing. Yeah, okay. And I still don't know. I know we've talked about this a million times. Is it them performing in the commercial? I never remember that.
That part I don't know.
I don't know.
I thought that it was, like, the song was almost the same, and they made a minor adjustment, but you're saying that this is the same song and they just wholesale wrote totally new lyrics for it to be about Outback.
For the little sting there.
Let's go Outback tonight.
It's a great song, though. I mean, I love it, and I love that they're getting paid. You know, I love that. Yeah. Like, I know a lot of this is 2005, and we're like, you're selling out for Outback. It's like, so what? Yeah, they got paid. Now they get to make more albums and cool songs like this.
Yeah, I got no problem with that.
Yeah.
I'm glad we were able to tack on a little important music industry talk.
Right.
Oh, I almost forgot. What? A good Linda Tripp reference.
Oh, right.
A good Bill Clinton I did not inhale. I mean, let's be honest. I think this was a banner.
Right.
A banner Monday.
I'll
show.
Add that to the description. Including an in-depth review of AMC's Lodge 49 and some great Linda Tripp reference.
Tripp jokes.
There it is.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio. Or just listen to this episode again tomorrow and consider it Monday and Tuesday's show because we went almost 2 hours. We'll see you then. Until then, go bagels, go eat a Mariner, and please remember, no mountain too tall.
Good luck to all. Let's pretend I don't accept. Let's pretend we're in Antarctica. We'll be right back.
power out.